You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 366, Revelation 4, Part 1. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Mike Heiser. Hey, Mike, what's going on?
You know, I guess you guys, are you still getting any kind of cold weather? I mean, a few weeks ago, it was like the Arctic there. We didn't get that. It just feels like I moved at the right time, I guess. But how's everybody doing?
Texas was colder than parts of Alaska there for a little bit. And where I'm at, we got almost 15 inches of snow in one day. And yes, I am in Texas, West Texas. And we got...
Hopefully there won't be another one.
Yeah. Knock on wood. But us Texans, we made it through. You know, now it's March and it's warm and ready to work on my tan.
You're going to have to... Yeah, but you'll probably spend most of the rest of the year suffering through all the talk about what caused it and what to do and all that kind of stuff. So you guys will be the focus for a while. I'm just glad to be in Florida. What can I say?
Yeah, I'm jelly.
What can I say?
Have you gotten in your pool yet?
Yeah. No, but Calvin has. The pugs have. Norman did anyway, you know, so... He just makes us nervous. You know, when he sees Calvin going in, it's like, oh, okay, you know, maybe I'm not scared. You know, yeah. Maury could care less. You know, he's just like, where's the location of my next nap?
Yeah, he knows how to float.
Yeah, well,
I know he didn't learn it from you.
It's only between 5 and 6 feet at the deep end, so yeah, he can stand in it. You know, ironically, we had all the kids do swimming lessons, you know, so they should be okay.
Oh, that's good. That's an important life skill, Mike. Everybody should learn how to swim.
That's what I hear.
Yeah. You need to learn how to swim. Maybe you can get them to teach you how to swim. And then please film that for all of us to watch, because that would be
gold. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll get right on that.
That'd be gold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know what I'm doing this weekend. No.
Yeah. All right, Mike. Well, hey. We had a nice 2-week break from Revelation.
Yeah. Today we're going to do Revelation 4, but it's only part one. You know, we're going to hit stretches like this too, where there's just something that's sort of lurking behind the backdrop of a chapter or that we have to sort of cover first. And that's going to set up, you know, some of the drill down stuff. So, you know, today we're going to look at Revelation 4, get our feet wet there. And again, what we're doing in this series is it's all about the use, the repurposing of the Old Testament in the book of Revelation. And today we're going to see how John repurposes an Old Testament genre. And that is called in Old Testament scholarship the covenant lawsuit genre. It's also known as the covenant lawsuit treaty. So there's a lot of scholarship behind this. There's a pretty solid consensus of scholarship, in fact, that Revelation 4 and 5 is a divine council scene that utilizes features of the covenant lawsuit genre from the Old Testament. So today, we want to be talking about what that genre is, what are the elements, and once we go through the elements, you're going to kind of see, if you think about Revelation 4 and 5, that, yeah, you know, the chapter does kind of like unfold in this particular way. And that's going to inform certain items in these chapters, basically how to read them. Or this is the bigger picture, Old Testament bigger picture. Here's what the passage is accomplishing. And then there's this other thing over here that's a little more, you know, nuanced or drill down into a specific passage that John, you know, might use or repurpose. In part two. So, you know, this is going to be fairly broad, this episode. Now, we've had on the show before Alan Bandy, and I'm going to be interacting with three sources here, really using three sources. They're all dissertations, and they've all been since, you know, I'm sure revised in some way and published into expensive books. So I'm going to be using the dissertations. I've uploaded all three of these dissertations into the protected folder for the podcast. So if you want, you know, to get a hold of the original dissertation, and not the published book, you can do that. And so any page number I refer to here is going to be on, you know, about the dissertation, not the book. But Bandy's dissertation is one of these. And again, we've had Alan Bandy before to talk about his work. And so we're going to sort of revisit parts of that. And then I'm going to add a few other things from some other sources. So Bandy's dissertation was entitled The Prophetic Lawsuit in the Book of Revelation. This is his PhD dissertation from Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary in 2007. He is going to reference an older dissertation a lot. I mean, he references a number of works, but one of them is a dissertation by R. Dean David. And the title of that one was The Heavenly Court Scene of Revelation 4 and 5. This was a PhD dissertation done at Andrews University in 1987. And the third source that I'll draw on is Myra Kensky. Her dissertation was Trying Man, Trying God, subtitle The Divine Courtroom in Early Jewish and Christian Literature. This is a University of Chicago dissertation from 2009. And I should add that her work actually includes a chapter on rabbinic literature too, even though the title, you know, doesn't make that completely evident. Because when you see early Jewish, you think Second Temple Judaism, not rabbinics, but she actually has a chapter on rabbinics as well. So I'm going to be interacting with all three of these to sort of explain, you know, what is the covenant lawsuit genre and how does it show up in Revelation 4 and 5? And to be honest with you, you know, there are scholars that would argue that the whole book of Revelation draws on this genre in a number of respects, but we'll drift off into that a little bit, but we're going to maintain our focus here on these two chapters. So what I'm going to start with Bandy's, you know, dissertation, what he does, again, he is going to, you know, as sort of the title indicates, the prophetic lawsuit in the book of Revelation. I mean, his dissertation is not isolated to chapters 4 and 5. So he's going to, in his dissertation, show how the prophetic lawsuit, this covenant lawsuit genre, is utilized and repurposed in various places in the book of Revelation. So what he does in his dissertation is he begins with discussing all the literature that has gone before, you know, the work that has been put into the prophetic lawsuit genre, and then noting specifically writers as well that dip into the book of Revelation for this here and there. And then his work's really going to expand on the theme and really give it concerted attention specifically in the book of Revelation. So he goes through, you know, in his introduction, lots of different approaches to this. So it's very evident that there's some kind of covenant or treaty or lawsuit background. Like when you hear lawsuit, think a courtroom scene. All right. You know, Bandy points out, you know, scholars have noticed this for a very long time. The only question is, well, which genre or which ancient Near Eastern, you know, genre or examples are the best ones, you know, to really understand what's going on here. So he goes through all these different options in his early chapter, and he notes, you know, strengths and weaknesses of a bunch of them. For instance, when he veers into Revelation, he refers to David Chilton's work. Chilton, I presume he's still living. His book that Bandy spends a lot of time on is Days of Vengeance, an exposition of the book of Revelation, which was 1987, so it's not that old. But anyway, Chilton is sort of in the Christian theological arena. He's eschatologically, he's a preterist. In that arena, you know, Christians who do eschatology, he's one of the few that really spent a lot of time on this covenant framework for the book of Revelation. So he spends a lot of time, Bandy does, you know, talking about Chilton and, you know, again, strengths and weaknesses, you know, some critiques here and there. One of his critiques of Chilton is he depends a lot on Meredith Klein's articulation of covenant elements that we should be paying attention to. And, you know, Klein wrote earlier, you know, than the 1980s. And so, you know, some of that work is going to suffer because it hasn't been brought up to date. Again, this is just a chronological issue. But, you know, to be more specific, on page 38, Bandy writes this. He says, the 5 points of the covenant structure, this according to Chilton, include 1, a preamble to identify the king, a historical prologue, that's number 2. Number 3 is ethical stipulations, in other words, the terms of the covenant. 4, sanctions outlining blessings and cursings, and 5, succession arrangements dealing with future generations. And so he talks about how, you know, Chilton views the backdrop of the Book of Revelation as essentially a lawsuit against Israel, against Jerusalem, and so on and so forth. And that's going to lead him in a certain direction in interpreting the book that, you know, fits really nicely in the preterist camp. Bandy writes, Chilton views the covenant lawsuit describing the last days of the covenantal nation of Israel, which was fulfilled with the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And then he writes, Chilton's approach, however, differs from most scholars in that he arrives at the lawsuit through his covenant framework for Revelation instead of through the occurrences of juridical language and imagery. This results in part from the fact that his commentary is an exposition of the English text rather than the Greek. Likewise, Chilton argues that Revelation does not contain a prophetic lawsuit, but it is a lawsuit based on the five-point structure of ancient Near Eastern covenants. And he gets that from Klein. The problem with this thesis is that he overstates his case for the covenant framework serving as the structure for Revelation. And then elsewhere he says, to say that the entire book of Revelation intentionally follows the structure of ancient Near Eastern vassal treaties proves difficult to validate. Let me just stop there. So what Bandy's going to do is he's going to say, look, there's a better option than what Klein was doing. Not all the book of Revelation is a covenant or belongs in the covenant structure, but various parts of the book of Revelation do construct scenes like their lawsuit scenes, again, courtroom scenes. Revelation 4 and 5 is the most prominent of these. So he's going to say, you know, an approach like Chilton's a bit exaggerated. So I bring up Chilton because, again, he is in the Christian orbit. You know, we're going to have listeners who are familiar with Chilton, and they're going to think that covenant lawsuit backdrop to the book of Revelation is Chilton. It's not really the case. What Chilton was doing is something a little bit different. And again, Bandy's going through a whole bunch of people. But, you know, again, I picked Chilton because he's going to be familiar to a lot of people in the audience. So pluses and minuses, just like everything else. Again, one of the things he likes about Chilton is that, for instance, his insight that the 4 series of 7 judgments in the book of Revelation are based on Leviticus 26. Warrants serious consideration. Again, that's going to show up later in the book and in some of the specific things we see in the book of Revelation. So again, there are important things here that a writer like Chilton and those who follow him are going to be tracking on, but that is not what we're going to do today. That is not what we mean by the covenant lawsuit genre. It's bigger than what Meredith Klein wrote. It's bigger than what Chilton wrote, and it's also different in some respects. So the observation, let's just take as our point of departure here, this 4 series of 7 judgments based on Leviticus 26, that's going to factor into Bandy's own contribution that the sections of the book of Revelation, various sections, are framed by, again, this prophetic courtroom, this prophetic drama sort of scene. If you think back to Leviticus 26 and passages like Deuteronomy 28 and 29, where God lays out, again, these basically the stipulations for blessing, and then if those are violated, then you're cursed. Those passages, Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28, 29, are often used in the Old Testament in other places as the basis for the prosecution. In other words, God is upset at Israel's apostasy, and then a prophet will put Israel in a courtroom scene, and God begins to build a case against his people, Israel. And, you know, this is going to in part explain why, you know, the Assyrians are going to come and conquer you, or why the Babylonians are going to come and conquer you. So these cursings, you know, they come from these earlier chapters, these violations of the covenant. I mean, Leviticus 26 is Torah. Deuteronomy 28 and 29 is Torah, okay? It's part of the covenant, you know, God makes with Israel. These violations are going to become the basis for God's judgment. And articulating the case against Israel is going to be part of the covenant lawsuit genre. So all of that's legit. Again, where Bandy would say Chilton goes too far is to try to make like the whole book of Revelation somehow following these covenantal structures and whatnot. Again, it's an exaggeration of the case. But the case itself in parts of the book is legit. And Revelation 4 and 5 is a big place where this is very evident. Plus, it takes place in the divine courtroom. So it's a divine council scene. Now, you know, Bandy, again, you know, summarizes all this, and he gets to the part of his dissertation where he gets into R. Dean Davis's dissertation, which is one of the three sources I mentioned at the beginning. So part of Davis's dissertation deals with the Divine Council specifically as a deliberative body. Again, think of a courtroom, sort of like God as judge. Okay, and the council is the jury, or at least they're participating jurors in concert with God, who in many cases, God is also the jury. He's the judge and the jury and the prosecutor in some of these scenes. And Bandy writes of Davis's study. Again, here's how he summarizes it. He says, Davis's thematic analysis of Revelation 4 and 5 attempts to portray, one, a covenant context within a temple setting. Think of God's throne room here. Two, a heavenly court scene involving a divine council. And three, an investigative type judgment of the Lamb in corporate solidarity with his people. Davis isolates five themes evident in chapters 4 and 5, which includes A, temple theology, B, ontological cosmic unity, C, judgment, D, covenant and royal theology, and E, Trinitarian involvement in salvation. The subsequent chapters attempt to explicate these themes as they relate to the Old Testament and Revelation. Now, some of that language, especially investigative judgment, is going to sound like Seventh-day Adventist theological stuff. And that's correct, because Davis is an Adventist. And Andrews University, where he did this dissertation, is an Adventist school. And Bandy's well aware of this. And so, you know, he's going to push back on some of that kind of content. But the important thing about Davis's work for us, and really from what Bandy's doing, is again, bringing the Divine Council sort of front and center into this. And so he writes elsewhere about Davis. He says, a major corollary to Davis's analysis of the heavenly courtroom scene is the presence of the Divine Council. In chapter 4, Davis reviews 1 Kings 22, Isaiah 6, Ezekiel 1 through 11, and Daniel 7 as significant Old Testament passages for interpreting the role of the Divine Council, heavenly beings, in Revelation 4 and 5. After a summary of each passage, he provides an analysis of what those passages reveal about the Divine Council. Davis also discusses the terms, location, members, and decisions of the Divine Council in an integrative summary. He argues that in the covenant lawsuit, Yahweh functions as both the prosecutor and judge, whereas a member of the Divine Council functions, in other words, like the Son of Man or somebody like that, members of the Divine Council function as a witness, Job 16:19, a vindicator, Job 19:25, a mediator, Job 33:23 and 24, an intercessor, Isaiah 53:11 and 12, Hebrews 7:25, and an advocate before God, Daniel 7:13, Daniel 7:27. In these Old Testament passages, the council convenes before divine actions are taken, suggesting that its primary function is executive or judicial decision-making. The council passes judgment within the context of the covenant, and on that basis, a verdict is followed by subsequent actions. I'll just stop there. Again, we've talked before, and I talked about this in Unseen Realm, about there are certainly some passages where you see divine council participation in the decision-making process of God. You know, and that in other places, it's nuanced a different way, that the council carries out a decision made. In 1 Kings 22, again, this is a classic text, 1 Kings 22, 19 through 23, it's time for Ahab to die. God has already decreed, you know, that, okay, that Ahab needs to go. And so, you know, the council is called together, and God says, hey, you know, how are we going to do that? You know, let's hear what you propose. So he lets them participate. And then, you know, the spirits, you know, go back and forth, and the spirit steps forward. So I got a great idea. I'll be a lying spirit in the mouth of all these prophets. And God says, yep, that'll work. You know, I know Ahab pretty well. That he's going to be toast, you know, when you try that on him. So, you know, there's this participatory element. So I wanted to read that paragraph specifically, even though it's a summary, it doesn't get into the nuts and bolts, so that, again, this audience knows that when you hear this kind of stuff about a divine council and participating in God's, you know, judgment and working for God, and again, God allowing them, you know, again, some input, this kind of thing, it's not just Crazy Mike, okay? It's not that Heiser guy. This is just mainstream scholarship, okay? This is Old Testament scholarship. I'm just letting you know it's there. And again, in Unseen Realm, it becomes part of Unseen Realm. This is what I do in Unseen Realm, is try to make biblical scholarship about, you know, the flow of biblical theology, decipherable and digestible to, you know, normal people, people who aren't going to go out and get degrees, but they already know that the way scholars talk and think about the scriptures is a lot different than what you hear in church. Okay, so we're filling in lots of gaps here, and I'm exposing you. My views on things are not idiosyncratic. This is why I clutter my books with resource references, footnotes, okay? I do that for a reason, because I want you to know this other work is out there. You just didn't know it was out there. Here's where to find it. Buy the book, get the journal article, whatever it is, and away you go. You know, I want to sort of empower the audience to do the research. So I wanted to include that passage, you know, about, you know, Dean's study here. You know, what Dean does from that point on is he has like a mini commentary on Revelation 4 and 5 in his dissertation, you know, again, from the Divine Council perspective. So let's just move on a little bit here. Davis, again, R. Dean Davis, again, is the one that focuses on council a lot. And also the third dissertation source, Kensky's dissertation, they have chapters in their respective dissertations overviewing sort of how the heavenly court or the heavenly council works, you know, some of it's speculative. Kensky takes a, how can I describe her? Bandy's an evangelical. Davis is in the Adventist context. Kensky is Jewish, but I think her writing's a little bit more cynical too. But it's still really good stuff, you know, lots of good data. But they, you know, every writer sort of has to, they go off on trajectories and, you know, speculate here and there about, you know, how the council would actually work or not. But Davis and Kensky both attempt to do this. And I'm gonna give you a little sample of what Kensky says here and try to read between the lines a little bit, because I actually kind of like, you know, what she does in the beginning of her dissertation here. She says, throughout the Hebrew Bible, there are images of God holding trial and acting in a judicial capacity. Sometimes these images appear in narrative presentations, such as the visions of Micaiah bar Imlah, it's 1 Kings 22, Zechariah 3, and the prologue to Job. Job 1 and 2. At other points, as in Psalm 50, the framework is poetic, leaving the reader to fill out the narrative setting. Still, other texts are legal in nature and imagine God's courtroom not only as occurring in some heavenly realm, but also as intersecting with the human courtroom on the ground. All these texts bear witness to the flexibility of this scene for different rhetorical and religious purposes. Sometimes the courtroom imagery is found for purposes of consolation, comfort, and hope. At other points, the courtroom framework is used to provoke shame or regret and repentance. Often these reasons coincide as more than one is intended at any given moment. Then I'll skip a little bit. The divine courtroom in the Hebrew Bible is not always visible to the naked eye. Often the texts which become most central to later interpreters, even later interpreters within the canon itself, are not prima facie instances of the divine courtroom. Only an understanding of the divine courtroom as a deeply ingrained feature of the religious imagination of ancient Israel can reveal the importance of these texts. And she gives an example. One such example occurs on Mount Sinai. Having displayed extraordinary boldness before God, advocating for Israel after the golden calf, Moses insists that God show him his ways so that he may know him, Exodus 33:13. The request to know your ways, quote-unquote, is nothing less than a desire to penetrate the workings of the divine mind and to understand the process of divine decision-making, to perceive how God functions. And she goes on and, you know, talks about, you know, God's response to Moses and whatnot. Again, I use the word, maybe she's a little bit cynical in places, because I think she, let me put it this way. I'll just kind of summarize my thought here. On one hand, it's true that God's decisions and actions can be perceived by the reader as being unjust or a bit nasty. Okay, that's true on the surface, but in the context of covenant violation, it's really hard, again, for me to say that God is being unjust, because essentially they had fair warning here, you know? So, you know, she riffs on that sometimes, and I think a little bit too negatively. Again, she drifts into what she perceives as some moral ambiguities about, you know, God's decision making and so on and so forth. But again, it's kind of a I don't want to call it a secular reading. I mean, because she's Jewish, and I can't make any other assumptions beyond that. But maybe she's filtering a little bit of this through the Jewish experience and whatnot. I don't know. It's a good dissertation. There's a lot of good material here, good data, and. It's wonderful that she's paying attention, you know, to this whole theme. But if you read all three of these, hers is going to feel a little bit different, again, because of the way she takes, you know, certain things about, you know, what God is doing or God's behavior, so to speak, in the courtroom, you know, stacking the deck against the one under trial. Well, okay, if God really knows the heart, well then. Is that the proper way to characterize God as stacking the deck? God either knows or he doesn't, and his knowledge of the person or the people is not going to be fallible. So anyway, I just thought I'd throw that in case, you know, we have people, you know, go out and read either hers or all three of them. This one's going to feel a little bit different, but it's pretty thorough, you know, in terms of the passages that pertain and what I just read there. You know, she says, look, if you know the court setting, if you know how ingrained this was in the religious and cultural understanding of people in ancient Israel, you're going to read other passages where a courtroom setting is not spelled out, and you'll just sense that that's what's going on. So she, you know, her dissertation, I think, is pretty thorough and well worth, you know, having, you know, as a resource. You know, she has sections on God as judge, handing down decisions. She gets into covenants there. For instance, this is unique to her. You're not going to find this in the other two. She has commentary about the use of divination and mediators like the Urim and the Thummim and the high priest, you know, how they function in God's decision-making, you know, capacities. She talks about there's a hope of individuals in certain passages that are on trial, whether it's the Israelites or some specific person, that they hope that God will not be impartial. They don't want God to be impartial. They want him to favor Israel versus the nations, for example. So, you know, she'll say, well, is that really fair? Well, you know, it is. It is fair. Again, based upon all the history that's, you know, gone, you know, before this, you know, she has a lot of these little rabbit trails that are just kind of interesting. She has a section on how God is to be approached. And here she gets into Abraham and Moses about how they negotiate with God in regard to a decision. Again, she sees in these scenes, let's just use those as an example, Abraham and Moses, she sees not only what's happening on the ground, okay, as this is, you know, God's divine decision making, you know, and then Moses and Abraham, you know, they're allowed to dicker with God and negotiate and whatnot. But she will say, by analogy, this also happens in the divine council, or you actually have here, because you also have two other witnesses, these two angels, okay, that in the scene with Abraham anyway. And you could argue by extension the one with Moses, whether it's not just the burning bush. It's the whole scene at Sinai where the law is given, you know, by the hand of angels. I mean, there are other witnesses here. She's saying, you know, when Moses has these conversations with God and when Abraham has these conversations with God, they're actually part of the courtroom scene. They're actually part of the council decision, looping humans in. Again, that's unique to her dissertation. So this is why I say it's pretty thorough. It's very interesting. But again, it's going to be different than the other two. So anyway, on page 37, she gets into what this is Hebrew terminology, the reev, that's R-I-B, but you'd pronounce it reev like it's R-I-V. The reev pattern. Reev is the word for dispute or lawsuit or quarrel or any one of those. This is the covenant lawsuit idea. The reev pattern, the reev genre. And she writes this: one of the most important ways in which the divine courtroom appears in the Hebrew Bible is through its invocation of the so-called prophetic lawsuit or reeve pattern form of prophetic speech. Throughout the prophetic literature, the prophets indict the people of Israel for various crimes against God, all of which ultimately lead up to the breach of covenant. For the prophets, this justifies God's intention to punish the people for their misdeeds. This form of prophetic address, therefore, is an explanation of why God's actions are just. The prophets use the legal language as a means of expressing God's formal complaints and rights as a litigant, an injured party, and show, through the mechanisms of human justice, how God's actions are themselves functions of divine justice, even though on the surface they may not seem so. Now, she uses as a template example Micah 6:1-8. I'm not gonna read it because I'm just gonna give you the sort of the bullet points here. You'll get some translation here. I'm not sure this is Kensky's own translation or if she's using it, maybe the JPS Torah translation. I don't know. But she's going to go through Micah 6:8, where Micah indicts the southern kingdom of Judah for social injustice and ethical improprieties. Now, this isn't a divine council scene, but this gives you the elements of a typical courtroom scene where God is putting Israel on trial, in this case, putting the southern kingdom Judah on trial, and sort of how these scenes function. So this is pages 37 and 38 in her dissertation. Hear what Yahweh is saying. Arise, contend with the mountains. Now, the word contend there is reeve. Okay, so it's a legal term. So when you see that as an Israelite, a Hebrew reader, you know, okay, this is a lawsuit. This is lawsuit terminology. God's going to bring a case here. Arise, contend with the mountains, and let the hills hear your voice. Hear, mountains, the case, reeve, of Yahweh, and everlasting foundations of the earth. For Yahweh has a case against his people. He has a reeve, there it is again, against his people, and he will reprove his people. My people, what have I done to you, and with what have I wearied you? Answer me. For I brought you out from the land of Egypt, from the house of slavery I redeemed you. And I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. My people, remember what Balak, the king of Moab, devised and what Balaam, son of Beor, answered him. From Shittim to Gilgal, in order to know the justices of Yahweh. How shall I come before Yahweh? Bow down before the God of heights. Shall I come before him with burnt offerings? This is the prophet's voice now. Or shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with year-old calves? Will Yahweh be pleased with thousands of rams, with tens of thousands of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgressions, the fruit of my belly for the sin of my soul? He has told you, man, what is good, and what does Yahweh seek from you but to do justice, to love chesed, and humbly walk with your God? So we have a case, you know, there's charges given by Yahweh against the people. Like, I haven't done bad things to you, and, you know, I've done all these good things to you. And again, in the context, Micah 6, we have all these abuses happening in Judah. And so it's like, you know, what does God really want? You know, what does God consider just? I mean, what's he really after here? You know, does he want you to bring sacrifices and bow down with calves and your firstborn and rams? And, you know, no, what he wants, he's told you what to do, what is good. You know, to do justice, to love chesed, you know, this loving loyalty idea, and to walk humbly with your God. So Micah 6:1-8 lays out this case against the people. It's done with legal language. So the language used in here, in the Israelite context, this was courtroom, you know, jargon, okay? And you've seen court cases on TV, or you know whether it's fictional portrayals or something else. You know that how things get discussed in a court of law are different than just a normal conversation. Well, when you hit again the terminology used here, the reader will instantly know Judah's on trial. And the point here is that this language and the trappings of the scene, you know, the prosecutorial stance, you know, the witness is called, you know, to bear witness against the whoever's the defendant for their crimes and all this stuff. Sometimes these sorts of settings occur specifically in, you know, divine council scenes where God is enthroned in his, you know, heavenly temple, his house. Okay, this is where the divine council meets, all that stuff. So these elements, again, play out in a lot of these scenes where God is, you know, prosecutor and judge, in some cases even jury. Divine council members play different roles. And I'm going to go back to Davis here. Davis, you know, again, summarizes some of this. He says, An examination of the activities of the members of the Divine Council reveals that they fulfill several different functions, including some specific roles. They surround the head of the council as attendants, 1 Kings 22:19, Ezekiel 1, 12 through 14, Daniel 7, 10. Again, Daniel 7 is a big deal here. And I want you to hold on to that from this point forward, because Daniel 7 is going to be the backdrop, specifically the passage that John uses when he writes Revelation 4 and 5. Daniel 7 is a divine council scene. Daniel 7, 9, 10, really 9 through 13. That's why Revelation 4 and 5 is very clearly a divine council courtroom scene. All right? Back to Dean. It says, again, the council members support the divine throne for the head of the council. And he gives various references. I'm not just going to list out all the references here. They praise and adore the head of the council. Job 38 is a classic. Psalm 29, 1 through 2. Psalm 89, 5 through 6. Again, this is all divine council stuff. Isaiah 6, 3. They participate in the council proceedings. 1 Kings 22, 20. They give counsel. Isaiah 44, 26. They're there to promote justice among the peoples. Psalm 82, that's what they're supposed to be doing. And serve as guardians or watchers. Daniel 4. And several references in there. After the council decision has been made and announced, they serve as messengers of the decision. Exodus 14, 19, Numbers 22, 31, 1 Kings 22, 21 through 22, Isaiah 6, 8 through 9. Individually, Gabriel appears to be a specially named messenger in some of these contexts, Daniel 8, 16, for instance. A special role appears to be taken by one who is an intercessor, witness, or advocate for the faithful on earth before the head of the council. He brings up Psalm 89 here, which we've talked about before on the podcast. In Daniel 7, 13 and 14, the one like a son of man appears to serve as the witness or intercessor on behalf of the saints, the holy ones of the Most High, and the people of the saints of the Most High, Daniel 7, 25 through 27. And from that point on, Dean quotes Mullen's classic study of the divine council. Again, this is from Mullen's book, page 228. It's very hard to find this, but you know, you can get it. You can still find it in PDF here and there. Theodore Mullen writes, in Hebrew thought, Yahweh functions as both prosecutor and judge when a negative judgment is rendered in frequent Old Testament divine reeve lawsuit contexts. Again, Mullen's all over the same set of information. I'm not going to read it because it's repetitious. And Davis goes through Mullen's work, and then he observes that in all major council scenes, all the big ones, the ones that are most familiar, 1 Kings 22, Isaiah 6, Ezekiel 1 through 11, and Daniel 7, all of them have the head of the council seated on a throne. God, the king judge, is attended to by various members of the heavenly host. And sometimes those members, at least some of them, are also seated. Daniel 7, the thrones were placed, plural. Isaiah and Ezekiel situate the throne inside the temple. So there's a temple setting implied for these judgment scenes. The temple, of course, is where God abides and the place from which he rules, so that makes sense. There is evidence, Daniel 4, Daniel 7, 1 Kings 22, of participation in decision-making and counsel, so on and so forth. Now, what Bandy's going to do, again, he goes through, Dean's work and some of this other stuff, and so on and so forth. What Bandy's going to do is say, okay, if you have all that in your head, and you look at Revelation 4 and 5, you're going to notice some things right away. He summarizes the parallels, and so I'm going to use his summary to sort of head towards setting up the next episode here for us. He writes on pages 44 and 45, again, if you go get his dissertation. He says, first, God is described as the head of the divine council in terms drawn directly from the Old Testament. You look at how God is described in Revelation 4 and 5, it's going to come out of the Old Testament in these scenes. Second, the 24 elders function in a capacity similar to the divine council in the Old Testament. And he quotes, he actually cites here Isaiah 24, 23, Yahweh, among his elders. In Israel, elders traditionally served as community leaders or royal officials who participated in council sessions and sat as judges. Third, Davis contends that other beings like the seven spirits of God, the four living creatures, John, a strong angel, the Lamb, the myriad of angels, all these characters, even every creature in the cosmos could all be classified as members of the divine council in these scenes. Okay. Fourth, the issue before the council is the worthiness of the Lamb to open the sealed scroll. The final evidence that Davis cites is that of the judicial nature of the scroll itself. He states that the seals were used to provide legal validity to the document that Davis maintains is the Lamb's Book of Life. Now, that's Davis's interpretation of the scroll. But again, you get this courtroom trapping sort of feel, you know, this context. Bandy, again, he's very positive of what Davis is writing. You know, he tweaks it here and there, because what he's going to do in his own work is sort of improve the council elements here. The fourth chapter of Bandy's dissertation is entitled An Exegetical Survey of the Prophetic Lawsuit in the Second Vision of Revelation. It's Revelation 4:1 through 16:21. So he takes it all the way to chapter 16, chapters 4 through 16. We're only focused here, at least at this point, on Revelation 4 and 5. So I want to get into, again, some of the things in 4 and 5 here just as setup. But I can't exclude what Bandy writes about the first three chapters. We've already been through the first three chapters, and we've done this drill down thing. But now that we're at chapters 4 and 5, there's stuff in Revelation 1 through 3 that contributes to or is in some way involved with this covenant lawsuit, divine counsel, courtroom thing that you're going to get hit in the face with, you know, when you get out of chapter 3 and into chapter 4. So Bandy summarizes it this way. He says, the letters to the seven churches constitute lawsuit speeches whereby Jesus conducts a forensic examination of his covenant people. I mean, just think about the content of Revelation 1 through 3, these letters to the churches, okay? Back to Bandy. He says, the form of the letters generally distinguishes them as prophetic oracles, similar to the Old Testament prophets, and more specifically, as covenant lawsuit speeches. As such, the book of Revelation follows the pattern of the Old Testament prophetic lawsuit that begins with the people of God. The judgments and promises announced for the churches in the seven letters remain contingent upon what they do in response to these oracles. In this sense, the remaining vision, especially the interludes, relates to how the churches respond. In other words, whether they faithfully endure as witnesses during the heightened state of persecution. Once the Lord deals with his people, he turns his attention to the surrounding nations with oracles of judgment. This pattern is established by the Song of Moses in Deuteronomy 32. There's Deuteronomy 32 again. Once the covenant people repent and obey, Yahweh promises to exact vengeance on Israel's pagan enemies. That's actually a reference to Deuteronomy 32:43. You know, if you read through Deuteronomy 32, I'm just going to break in here. You know, we get verses 8 and 9, which this audience knows well, the disinheritance of the nations, and Yahweh takes Israel as his own, okay? But then you keep reading all the way up to like verse 17, you know, when they worship the Shadim, you know, quote-unquote demons, you know, they worship, you know, gods that they had not known. Deuteronomy 32 shifts from the Babel event to an indictment of Israel for apostasy as you keep reading. What Bandy's saying is, look, this notion of, like in the book of Revelation, you get these oracles, these letters to the churches, where the people of God are being evaluated and judged, and in some cases commended, okay? And that's going to carry all the way through the rest of the book of Revelation. You know, how do God's people respond to what happens in the first three chapters, these letters? You know, do they hold fast under persecution? Do they refuse, again, to be disloyal, you know, to Yahweh? I mean, all these different sort of themes. And then once God's people get dealt with, then all of a sudden the attention in the book of Revelation shifts to the judgment of the nations. And of course, at the end, the nations are going to be, God is going to, you know, there's going to be healing of the nations ultimately. Okay, so if you know the whole flow here. And if you go to Deuteronomy 32 again, it begins, you know, with here's the way the situation was with Israel, and then Israel apostatized, and then, you know, God deals with Israel. And then eventually you get to verse 43 in Deuteronomy 32, where God is taking revenge against the gods, okay, gods of the nations and so on and so forth. So Bandy's saying, you know, this is the pattern of Deuteronomy 32. It just, you know, this is the lawsuit of Deuteronomy 32, and it's played out, it's tracked on in the book of Revelation. So back to Bandy, he says, the book of Revelation, likewise, sounds a note, similar note of judgment pertaining to the churches, but then the remaining contents of the vision pertains to the judgment of the nations. Significantly, the judgment of the nations is closely tied to the theme of revenge, vengeance, for their treatment of the saints, which is, again, Deuteronomy 32:43. So I would summarize it this way. In essence, Revelation 1 through 3 is both a lawsuit dealing with the followers of Jesus. You know, they get warnings and in some cases indictment, you know, and again, they get commended as well. It's a lawsuit, kind of a courtroom drama, a courtroom evaluation of the followers of Jesus. But at the same time, it's also building a case against the nations, because some of the churches that are the recipients of the letters have been, they have been faithful. They have endured under persecution, and they're suffering at the hands of the nations. So it's both evaluative, and all of that testimony is going to be used later to indict the nations. Now, Beale and Carson, if you think, I don't know, I'm not sure about Revelation 4 and 5 and all this divine counsel stuff. Okay, let's go to some familiar evangelical voices here, you know, other than me. Beale and Carson's commentary on the Old Testament used in the New Testament lays this out in 14 steps. Okay. They lay it out. They lay out the courtroom setting of Revelation 4 and 5 really nicely. Basically, they move from the divine council courtroom scene in Daniel 7 over to Revelation 4 and 5. So here's what they write. An overview of the two chapters together in Revelation 4 and 5 reveals that they exhibit a unified structure that corresponds to the structure of Daniel 7. You know, more, it corresponds more to the structure of Daniel 7 than any other vision of the Old Testament. If we begin with Daniel 7, 9 through 28, and observe the elements, you know, in that passage, and the order of their presentation in that passage, if we look at all that and say, well, you know, what about Daniel 7, 9 through 28? Is in common with Revelation 45, this is their words, a striking resemblance is discernible. I'm just going to go through the list. 1, introductory vision phraseology. Daniel 7, you know, align Daniel 7, verse 9, and then they loop in verse 2 and verses 6 and 7 with Revelation 4:1. It's going to look a lot alike. Setting of a thrones, or thrones in heaven, Daniel 7, 9a, Revelation 4:2a, and 4:4a. God sitting on a throne, Daniel 7, 9b, Revelation 4, 2b. Description of God's appearance on the throne. John even borrows the description. You have Daniel 7, 9c and Revelation 4, 3a. Fire before the throne, Daniel 7, 9 and 10, Revelation 4, 5. Heavenly servants surrounding the throne, Daniel 7, 10b, Revelation 4, 4b, so on and so forth. I mean, maybe it's a little too much detail, but 14 specific parallels between Daniel 7, and when we do the transcript, we'll just include, you know, the rest of them, but there are 14 specific parallels between Daniel 7 and Revelation 4 and 5, and they're in the same order. It's completely obvious, A, that Daniel 7 is a divine council scene, and B, John is, you know, riffing off of it in Revelation 4 and 5. He could not be any more explicit and detailed and thorough in the alignment. And Daniel 7, again, is a courtroom scene. It is part of this covenant lawsuit thing going on. In Daniel 7's case, of course, the four beasts, the nations are going to be judged. That they're the ones, you know, sitting under the, you know, under indictment, okay, in that scene. Here, again, you're going to have, you know, well, Daniel 7 also loops into people of God too, but here you're going to have in, I'll just pull out number 10 here, Beale and Carson. There's a reference to the kingdom, which includes all peoples, nations, and tongues. It's not just Israel. Okay, so you, again, you have, it's this full orb thing. You know, the kingdom of that is talked about in Daniel 7 isn't just the kingdom of Israel. Okay, the Son of Man is Lord of the nations. And over in Revelation 4, 5, the nations are going to be in view too. You're going to have both believers. Are they enduring? Are they holding up? You know, are they sustaining their belief, their faith? And what about the nations? You know, we are nearing, we are approaching, we're really in the process of the nations now coming under judgment. So you get the whole mix. it's very deliberate tracking between Revelation 4, 5 and Daniel 7. You know, just on and on and on it goes. So I think that's actually a good place to stop. And it's a good setup for part two, our next episode, because we can just conclude it this way. There is a solid consensus of scholarship, and there is an indisputable relationship between Revelation 4, 5 and Daniel 7. And Daniel 7 is firmly part of what we would call the covenant lawsuit genre in the Old Testament, this divine, and even more specifically, a divine counsel lawsuit scenes. Daniel 7 is right smack dab in the middle of that. It is a classic example, and Revelation 4 and 5 uses it 14 points, even in order. It's unmistakable. So there's a solid consensus of scholarship and data here that utilize all of this stuff. Again, this is the Old Testament context for the larger picture of Revelation 4 and 5. And with that as a backdrop, when we return in the next episode, we're going to drill down. We're going to start to drill down. I may be able to cover Revelation 4 in one more episode. We'll see. You know, once I get my head into the material, you know, maybe we'd have a part 3. I don't know yet. But we're going to be reading Revelation 4 against the backdrop of a divine council courtroom. Okay. And then within that, John is going to be bringing other Old Testament data in to articulate specific things, specific points, and illustrate specific things and specific points. So John has set the table. His readers know, if they know Daniel 7, which is a really fundamentally important passage, okay? If they know Daniel 7, they know just what the scene is in Revelation 4 and 5. And they're going to be reading with John this court proceeding. And as John goes through the courtroom drama, he's going to be drawing in other things to make the case and explain what's going on or what's going, you know, the things that are and things that are going to happen and so on and so forth. So that's, I think, a good place to stop and set up the next episode. So lots of Old Testament stuff going on here, both at the macro level and then, as we'll see next time, in very specific ways.
It's amazing how much Old Testament is in Revelation. So,
yeah.
You know, there's some other books out there, people, I don't have any off the top of my head as far as Old Testament and Revelation.
Yeah, our first episode, I think the introductory episode, I referenced three or four of these. Again, the ones, there's one by Beale, there's one by Stephen Moise. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. It's Moyse. Those are two sort of surveys. And then Beale and Carson's commentary is specifically aimed at Old Testament repurposing in the New Testament. Of course, they go through the whole book of Revelation there too. But if they go back to the introductory episode, you know, people can get these titles and you look at the transcripts too, but again, they're academic works, but you know, I would think a lot of the people in our audience, most of our audience, you know, could handle a lot of that content.
Well, we'll be looking forward to next week. And with that, Mike, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.